In this hour, Focus 580, we'll be talking about some of the problems associated with international adoption. Demand for adoptable infants has led many Americans to look outside of the United States for children to add to their family. Not only is it about having children, but they've been told that there are babies who are orphaned, who are unwanted, who are just waiting to be rescued. In fact, many of the children being adopted by Western parents today aren't orphans at all. We'll talk this morning in this hour about the growing concerns that babies perhaps have been bought or stolen from their birth families in developing countries and adopted by people in the West, sometimes people here in the United States. Our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is David Smolin. He is professor of constitutional law and director of the Center for Biotechnology, Law, and Ethics at the Cumberland School of Law. That's located at Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama. He's an expert in bioethics and biotechnology issues. He's also interested in international children's issues, including adoption, children's rights, child labor, and child trafficking. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. Questions from people who are listening are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their comments brief so that we can keep the program moving along. But of course, anyone is welcome to call. If you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you have a question, you have a comment, you are certainly welcome to call. Professor Smolin, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Sure.
Just can we review the numbers a little bit about international adoption? I think that we're a little bit off of the peak, which was a couple of years back, but the numbers are still pretty high. Can you tell us just what sort of numbers we're talking about?
Sure. Well, back in, say, 1994, there were about 8,000 children who came to the U.S. for intercountry adoption. And from 1994 to 2004, that almost tripled to 22,800. And so that was a large rise in that 10-year period from 1994 to 2004. Since then, it's gone modestly down. In 2005, 22,700, 2006, 20,000. And then in fiscal year 2008, it went down to about 17,000.
But that's still a pretty significant number, and particularly compared to what it was, you know, going back to the mid-90s.
Yes, but I think what has the international adoption community here in the U.S. somewhat panicked is that they look ahead and think that in 2009 it'll probably go down again, perhaps even more, maybe to 12,000, 13,000, 10,000, primarily because many of the primary source countries that have been sending children in large numbers look like they're going to go down. They've been going down, and we can look ahead and see, based on what's going on, that they're going to go down further.
So now this here is the next question I was coming to. If the number of international adoptions, that is, say, Americans who are adopting children from other countries, so that's gone down that significantly. I expect that that's not because of demand, that there are still Americans who would like to be parents and would be interested in adopting children. It's because the countries that were the origins of the children in the past are concerned about the business of international adoption, and they're placing greater controls and greater restrictions on children being adopted out of country.
That is true. What we have is a situation where China, Guatemala, Russia have represented two-thirds to three-quarters of the children coming here. So just those three countries have been primary players. And if you look at what's going on there, China just doesn't seem to have as many babies and as many toddlers as they used to have available. So China's a whole story in and of itself, because they were the by far leading provider. Russia has a large body of children who have been living in very bad settings, in poor living conditions. They're mostly older children, and they're still there. but that doesn't mean that there are large numbers of babies there. And Russia is starting to take steps to find alternatives to these orphanages there. And then Guatemala is a country that rose way up, country with only about 12 to 14 million people that was sending something like 1 in 100 of their babies to the U.S. And their system was a very corrupt system. And their system was the prototypal situation where children appear to have been bought or stolen for inter-country adoption in large numbers. There was a lack of controls, and the Guatemalan government is radically rechanging their system, and those numbers are expected to come down dramatically.
Well, just let's look at what is kind of the basic storyline that the people that people have heard about inter-country adoption, and that is that here we have people who really want to be parents. They want to provide, they want to have children. They want to provide a home to children who need it. So in part, it's about what they want. But at the same time, they are saying, you know, if I could provide a good home for a child that was orphaned or that wasn't wanted, well, not only would I be doing something for myself, I'd really be doing something for them. And they have this idea, we've been given this idea that there are places, and particularly, say, Russia or Guatemala or other places, where there are large numbers of children who are orphaned, abandoned, unwanted, living in bad conditions, and that there's this real need to do something important and significant to help them and give them a better life. Is there something wrong with that story?
Yes. Essentially, there are not very many babies, not very many toddlers who truly need inter-country adoption. What we have is a situation where there are older children, there are disabled children, similar to our foster care population here in the U.S., where we have a lot of children. We have about 550,000, 500,000 children in foster care in our own country. And that is a mostly older child population. And so if you go around the world, there are some numbers of older children like that who are living in institutions, but that's not who most people are interested in adopting. Mm-hmm. And for good reason, because it takes very specialized care to handle older children who have been traumatized, who have undergone institutional care, orphanage care. That's not just like adding a baby to your family. So if you just want a baby because you're unable to have one for whatever reason, then the truth of the matter is there aren't very many babies. And to the degree that there are babies, poverty may be the primary reason. And to the degree that poverty is the primary reason, it really isn't ethical to spend $20,000, $30,000 on an inter-country adoption when you could provide financial assistance to the family on the scale of maybe $200, $300, $400 per year that would enable the child to remain with their original family.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think that some people say, becoming aware of this situation, they'd say maybe, in fact, for the amount of money that would be spent in adopting and perhaps raising that child, that if what you really were interested in doing is trying to help children who are living in poverty, and that would be actually to take that money and to give it to their families so that their families, and they in fact, apparently in many cases, do have families, at least extended families, if not one parent, take that money and give it to them and let them stay with their families.
And, of course, there are programs that do that. What has happened is that the adoption agencies are not usually well connected to the kind of aid programs, child sponsorship programs, family sponsorship programs, community development programs. I mean, we are a very generous people, and we give a lot of money to both secular and also church, synagogue-oriented programs around the world that help children, that help families. And those programs actually reach a lot more children and a lot more families than inter-country adoption does. And in fact, if you look at the cost of one inter-country adoption in, say, Guatemala, $30,000, with maybe $15,000 to $20,000 of that until recently going to one intermediary in Guatemala, the amount of good that could be done there properly funneled to an aid agency would be much, much greater. We are dealing with a situation around the world where about 1 billion people around the world live on $1 a day or less. and about another 2 billion people in the world live on $2 a day or less. So that's about 3 billion out of the 6.5 billion people in the world. And when you look at that population group, when they're under stress, they need help, but that doesn't mean that their children need to be taken away from them.
Yeah. Well, there, one could imagine a couple of different circumstances, one where children literally are stolen, or perhaps families are coerced, or that somehow that they feel that they have no choice because they need the money and there's some money involved, or that there is a situation where for some reason that a family can't care for a child and they may be placed in some kind of institution, and it was never the idea of the parent or parents to give the child up completely, but then the people who are running that institution realize that that child means money to them, and so that child, they say, well, here we have a child that's an orphan, and they can fabricate a provenance, and what you have here is actually something that has been called child laundering. And I wonder, of the various scenarios, what is actually the more common?
Well, it goes country by country. Child laundering, where you abduct a child or get a child by fraud, falsified documents, the birth parents don't really understand what is going on. All of the things that you just laid out there have gone on in Guatemala, India, Nepal, Cambodia, Vietnam, a number of Latin American countries back in the early 90s before it was somewhat shut down in some of the other Latin American countries. So it is something that's been going on for decades. The problem is that most child laundering adoptions are, from a criminal point of view, successful. And that is, when you're adopting babies, they don't know what's been done. The adoption agencies and the adoptive parents have no real motivation to look into this. One of the things that I really want to say to potential adoptive parents out there is that the agencies, the U.S. adoptive agencies and the U.S. government that we have counted on to ensure that when we adopt a child, they are a true orphan, those agencies, governmental and the adoption agencies, have really let us down. Because what they've done is they've created an intercountry adoption system where we put a lot of money in the hands of foreigners and tell them we want babies. And we don't have a good way of checking on how those foreign orphanages or foreign facilitators, intermediaries, finders, scouts, whoever they are, we don't have a good way of looking at what went on when the child was actually obtained. But we've created this tremendous financial incentive, $5,000 per child in many, many countries, $15,000 in Guatemala, in countries where a middle-class person might live on $5,000 per year. We've told them that if you just get us one baby, we'll pay you $5,000. And so we've incentivized child laundering. And the U.S. government is trying now through the Hague, which is a new treaty that the U.S. government has just ratified this year. It is trying to put in new regulations, but they still have not controlled the amounts of money that go to the other countries in an adequate way. And the U.S. adoption agencies are well-intentioned usually, but they take somewhat of a see-no-evil, hear-no-evil attitude. We'll hire somebody, we'll give them all of this money, and we won't look too hard at how they get these kids.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is David Smolin. He is professor of constitutional law and also director of the Center for Biotechnology Law and Ethics at the Cumberland School of Law. That's at Samford University, located in Birmingham, Alabama. He is an expert in bioethics and biotech issues. He's also interested in international children's issues, including adoption, children's rights, child trafficking. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning. I just got in on the part where the suggestion was made. Actually, it was being touted that money given to the family of a child in another country would be less upsetting, or whatever the word would be. It would be better to do that than to adopt a child and bring the child here. I see lots of problems with that conclusion, but a question I have, how does one even know that there is a child? I mean, I understand that some of the ploys that have been used have been to have pictures of children and people receive pictures of children, but there's absolutely no way that they know, A, that there is a child for adoption or who needs help, and B, that child is going to receive anything that they send. So I think it's replete with problems.
Well, let me respond to the first part. I'm not saying that we personally, as U.S. citizens, should hand money to individual families. Obviously, what I'm saying is that there need to be aid programs that do that first, and that a child is not considered eligible for intercountry adoption simply because their parents are very poor. There ought to be first an aid program separate from the adoption program in place.
I see.
So, yes, it would be problematic for us to try to, just hand out money over there individually. Most of the time, the critical deeds are done before before we ever get over there as prospective adoptive parents. It's these intermediaries and these agencies that have to make sure that before a child is deemed eligible, that these other aids, alternatives, helps have been offered by some party.
I see.
In terms of your other comment, I really think there are two levels of fraud with intercountry adoption. The better U.S. agencies do not engage in the kind of fraud that you just talked about, which does happen, where there's literally no child and
yes,
they're just taking in money. That kind of thing happens. And if you do due diligence and go with the better established agencies, the longer term ones, you won't get burned in that way. But you're right that that has occurred. My real message to potential adoptive parents is that even if you do your homework and you screen out the highly fraudulent, really criminal American adoptive agencies and go with the longer-term, well-established ones, that even those do not screen out this other problem, the problem of how the child was obtained.
Absolutely. Well, as I say, I just called in when that particular point was being made about the comparison of the two, and knowing a family, a young man and a young woman, who have one of their own children and then they've adopted two Chinese children, it isn't just a matter of helping the world be better. I mean, they actually wanted these children in their lives, and they saw that their daughter and that their Urbana community and so forth would be richer in the sense of bringing up these children and having them be here. And so it's not just it's not all just public service. It's that parents or people who are not parents yearn to have children, and so they look at the various alternatives, and this one family is just supremely happy with their choice. And again, sending money to anything, a U.S., some kind of a supposed to be completely up above board agency, wouldn't in any way meet the needs that they feel, which is that they want to have more children and they would like to bring children from other countries because they think they can give them a better life.
Right, and I certainly understand that. The problem is that we do not have a right to other people's children. And to the degree that we're preying on a poor family's vulnerability, and that we're sending money to an intermediary and creating an incentive for that intermediary to trick that family, lie to that family, and so forth, I mean, that's not a proper way to meet that need.
Okay, so now we're talking about the process of how those families are chosen, how the children are chosen, and that's probably what you're very knowledgeable about. But I just wanted to react to what.
Sure. Well, thank you for your comments.
Sure.
And I guess by my raising that issue, we certainly would want to reinforce the point that people who are doing international adoptions, they're doing it because they want to have children, clearly, and that they're hoping to provide a good home for a child. And I guess my thought just was that there are some people who say that if part of the interest here is in trying to do something to address child poverty in the developing world, though, that there might be more effective ways to do that. And I don't know if people were really serious with the idea of, instead of adopting the child, why don't you just send that child's family money? That just may be something sort of for point of argument. I don't know if anybody's actually really thinking about doing that.
Let me kind of jump in here. I think that as an adoptive parent, or as a prospective adoptive parent, people need to think about what their relationship will be, not only with their child, but with the people that their child came from. Adoption is not really the same thing or a pure substitute for having a biological child. And the reason is that the child inevitably does have ties back to their original family. And that means it's more like a blended family situation. And so one of the difficulties is that if people want to adopt as a substitute for having their own child, they tend to take an adversarial or not wanting to know anything about the original family point of view, because they want this to be just their child. And that's not really what adoption is. Adoption, whether it's here in the U.S. or it's overseas, does involve a child that came from somebody else. And as that child grows up, maybe not when they're 5 years old or even when they're 10, but as that child grows up, they are naturally going to be curious about where they came from. Intercountry adoption adds to that complexity, the fact that, of course, if you're, say, a white parent adopting a child from China, you now have come into a special relationship with China, and that child has to sort out eventually, are they Chinese, are they American, are they white, and there are a lot of issues that really adoptive parents need to think about, even in terms of their relationship to the child.
We are at our midpoint here again. Just real quick, let me mention that our guest is David Smolin. He's professor of constitutional law and is also director of the Center for Biotechnology, Law, and Ethics at the Cumberland School of Law at Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama. And among the things he's interested in, international children's issues, including adoption and child trafficking. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Now, you know, I'm just curious, as after the conversation with the last caller, I'd certainly recall as a child there being international programs that were making the kind of pitch to people in the United States of saying, you know, there are children elsewhere in the world that are living in poverty that could use your help. And by making a small regular contribution, that money would go to that child and help provide for their basic needs and their education. And you'd get a picture and they would write you letters. And I don't feel that I still hear about programs like that that are still going on. Are there still programs like that that exist?
Oh, yes, very much so. A number of large-scale programs like that by, again, both church-based, also secular organizations, and there are hundreds of thousands of children who are being sponsored in that way. And I have to tell you that those programs, when they're done by good agencies, are very, very ethical, although there is even in them a certain amount of using the child as a way of kind of baiting you to help the family. Because when they're well done, which they often are, they actually don't aid just that one child. They go into a certain village, rural community, say, urban place, neighborhood, and they help the whole neighborhood. They help the whole village. They see about clean water. They see about crop development. They see about schools. They see about sanitation. And they do it for the whole community. And then they pick out a certain number of children who are almost always living with families, and they line them up child sponsors. And the reason that they do that is that we are far more willing to give for a child sponsorship program than we are willing to give for a family or a community sponsorship program. Hmm.
Let's talk with another caller. This is also someone here in Urbana where we are, line one. Hello?
Hi. A couple of years ago, I discovered Kiva.org, and I was just looking at their website again recently. This is a microfinance organization.
Right.
And for people who don't know it, you can choose someone to lend to, and a partner organization in that country that has been vetted by Kiva, which is a U.S. organization, will lend the loan is specified as to what it's for and how much it is, and various people contribute to the pot for a particular loan. One of their points is that this is one way to help people help themselves, and so that's another approach to this that would help families. You can choose the country, you can choose the type of entrepreneur that you're looking for, you can choose the sex of the person, and there's a brief piece of information about what the person's background and what they're trying to do. And when the money is repaid back, it gets put back in your Kiva account, and you can either withdraw it or you can relend it. And I think I've got 22 loans in 2 years. It's really a nice experience. So I suggest that to people to consider doing that. You need to set up a PayPal account so that you can lend the money. And the smallest amount you can lend is $25. But the other thing I wanted to say was that adoption is something that's pushed by anti-abortion groups as being the way to go. And that sounds very nice, but there are a lot of kids who end up being retained by parents who aren't ready to be parents, who maybe should never be parents, one or the other. And we do a lot of damage to kids whose parents don't want them but keep them, and some of whom then end up in the foster system. It seems to me that we as a society, and particularly those groups who say that adoption is the only way to go, should be doing more to help adoptive parents, to help foster kids with whatever problems they have, because those kids have a right to life and a right to happiness and a right to family as well. And we're not doing our job as a society when we don't address those needs better. Thanks.
All right. Well,
sure. Let me just comment on that. First of all, microfinance is a great thing. I can't comment on that particular program, but certainly people should look into it. So that is a good way to aid people overseas. Secondly, I think that the abortion-adoption link is an interesting topic. It plays out very differently here than in other countries. Here, only about 2% or less of single pregnant women give up their child voluntarily for adoption here in the U.S. So while that is pushed, and while I certainly think it is a legitimate alternative, basically in the U.S., in terms of single pregnant women, which isn't the only kind of crisis pregnancy, but here is the probably predominant kind, about half of women have an abortion, about half of women keep the child, and only about 2% give up for adoption. So that's one of the things, by the way, that feeds the big push into intercountry adoption, is that the babies just aren't available here. There are hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people who want to adopt, who want children, who don't have children, and there are maybe only 30 to 50,000 children a year available in the U.S. for infant relinquishment adoption.
I want to go back to what we're talking about here, basically the subject of international adoption and problems associated with it. And I'm just curious, you talked about how now the United States has signed on to an international agreement that aims at trying to get at some of the problems involved in intercountry adoption. But just in what way does the United States government involve itself in this arrangement? That is, in what way does it get involved when Americans want to adopt children from outside of the United States?
Well, first of all, even before we ratified the Hague, in order to bring a child to the U.S., you had to get some kind of what was called orphan visa. So it was a kind of immigration, really. And the U.S. government had certain procedures set up where they had requirements for what kind of situation constituted a, quote, orphan under U.S. law. Now that we've ratified the Hague, what it means is that the U.S. State Department has overall control of intercountry adoptions, and that means that they accredit the U.S. adoption agencies that oversee intercountry adoptions at least from those other countries that have also adopted Hague. One of the things that is happening now is that some of the agencies are going to non-Hague countries, countries that have not ratified this treaty, in order to bypass that additional supervision. But the problem is that even with that additional supervision, the U.S. government rules on the amounts of money that can go to the other countries, which is the real problem from my point of view. Those rules about money are still not nearly strict enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you talk in a little bit more detail, perhaps, about the Hague regime the Hague Convention on Inter-Country Adoption, and what if a country signs on to that, then what is that country required to do?
Right. The main thing that that country is required to do is to set up one entity within their government as a kind of central authority, it is called. Mm-hmm. And that central authority plays one role if they have a sending country, you know, sending children out. And it plays a different role if they are having children come into the country. The problem, really, even with the Hague regimen, is that it relies on the Hague sending countries to make sure that the children were properly relinquished or abandoned, that no monetary inducements were offered, and so forth. And the problem, again, is that even if you have a Hague sending country like, say, India, even if India signs on to the treaty, there's a lot of corruption in India. And if you offer the Indian agencies too much money, even if there's this bureaucracy in place that is putting their stamp of approval at multiple stages, the central Indian government and Indian court, the local Indian government, the essential interaction is between this birth mother, impoverished, illiterate, and some agency person who's been given too much money to obtain this child. It's very easy to falsify documents, and if that first document, the relinquishment document taken from a woman who can't even read and write, if that's a false document, then everybody else just puts their stamp of approval on it. So that's why even though The Hague creates these bureaucracies, these governmental entities that are responsible, until the money is sharply limited, I don't have any confidence in that regimen. Mm.
So you're one of the things that you're saying, and not just you, that other people are saying, is that there ought to be a cap put on the amount of money. And I'm sure that there are all sorts of associated costs with this process, but basically what you're saying is there ought to be a cap put on the amount of money that is essentially the payment for the child that goes to whomever.
To the overseas partners. Yes, mm-hmm. That's really what needs to be capped. And it needs to be enforced as well, because what's gone on in India is that the Indian government has published caps. And for years, I've checked out the actual fees that are charged by U.S. agencies as their foreign fees that are sent to other countries. And those fees were often 5, 6, 7, 8 times what the Indian government fee was allowed to be. But it just went on anyway. And, you know, that's been reported to the U.S. government that U.S. adoption agencies are violating Indian law as to what those fees are, and neither the Indian government nor the U.S. government has done a thing about it. So, again, just having a theoretical bureaucracy or some theoretical rules isn't enough. The rules have to be enforced.
And what sort of money are we talking about?
Well, essentially, in India, they were supposed to, say, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, pay $1 a day, or later got changed to $2 a day for every day the child was in care. It came to less than $1,000 U.S. in the total money that should have gone to the foreign orphanages. But instead of sending less than $1,000 per child, they were sending $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 per child to the intermediary, to the foreign orphanage. In, say, Guatemala, they were sending $15,000 to $20,000 to a foreign intermediary, to the lawyer there. So it's been pretty typical to pay the foreign intermediaries in countries that have millions of people living under, you know, $1 a day, millions more living under $2 a day, and where a middle-class family might be earning $10,000 a year, and we've been paying $5,000 to $20,000 per child.
Let's talk with another caller here. We have someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello, hi.
Yes.
I'm calling to make a comment on something you said earlier about most adoptive parents being reluctant or uninterested in keeping ties with the birth parents or the birth culture.
Right. What I said is that that's something that adoptive parents should do. How many do it and how many don't, I suppose you're going to say that a lot do it these days. Is that what you were going to say?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, I was going to say that I think you were right maybe 10 years ago, but I think the adoption culture has changed quite a bit. I am an adoptive parent of two, and I also have an enormous circle of friends who are adoptive parents. And I would say both in the examples of domestic and international adoption, these people are making enormous efforts to stay in touch with the birth parents. And when that is impossible in terms of international, these people are making efforts to make sure that the child has ties to the culture in terms of their own education here, as well as in taking trips at their expense to the country of origin and making sure that that child really has a relationship with their culture, original culture.
Well, that is great, too. Yes, I think that you're right that there's been a real shift. I think that it varies as to how many people are part of that shift. A part of my point was simply that if you are adopting because you're childless and you want a child, that you're going to have to be willing to do the kinds of things that you just said. So it's great to hear that you're doing that and that other people are.
Yes. Well, that's good. I was just making sure that the listeners understood that, yes, there is that responsibility, and the good news is that there are a lot of people out there doing that.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We're talking about international adoption and some of the problems that can be associated with international adoption. We're talking with David Smolin. He is professor of constitutional law. He's also director of the Center for Biotechnology Law and Ethics at the Cumberland School of Law at Samford University. That's located in Birmingham, Alabama. He's an expert in both bioethics and biotech issues. He's also interested in international children's issues, including adoption and child trafficking. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Now I'm thinking, we do know that there are people who really want to be parents and really want to have children and cannot and have turned to adoption. We also know that the number of healthy available infants is small, certainly here in the United States, and for a variety of reasons, and that for that reason, a lot of people have looked outside of the United States to adopt children, that the numbers of available children may indeed be declining, but there will still be children who will be available, and there will be people who will want to do that. If someone was thinking about doing that, could you give them any sort of counsel as to how to approach this so that they could try to not get into the kind of situations that we've talked about, not in a sense being a party, I'm not saying that they would be willingly a party, but being a party to child laundering?
Sure. Well, it's very difficult to know what to say because there are a number of well-intentioned people, and I'm sorry if I sound like I'm trying to scare people, but it's been the what I've seen is that a lot of people have thought that if you just go with a mainstream agency and you check them out and they've been around for 20 years or 30 years, that you're safe. And what I want to say is that you need to go beyond that. That's a good starting place. You need to investigate the situation in the actual country where you're thinking about adopting from. And if you're thinking about adopting internationally, it is important to pick a country that you feel good about, that you don't mind and want to have a lifelong tie to, because your child will be of that place and will have ties to that place even if they come here as a baby. So you have to pick a country that you feel comfortable with, but then you have to ask, is that country's inter-country adoption system capable of sorting out the true orphans from the laundered children? And in a lot of cases, I just have to say I don't think they are. I think that we've had some countries, many countries shut down, countries like Cambodia, Vietnam, Guatemala's been in and out, Nepal, and in a lot of those places, the problem is if you adopt from there, you'll really never know for sure either way. And even if you try to do a birth search, maybe you'll find out, maybe you won't. And so you don't want to adopt from a place where the infrastructure is not in place to sort this out. Secondly, you want to make sure that you're not creating an incentive. So you have to look at the fees that you're paying. And I'm not as concerned about the fees that your U.S. placement agency keeps, but I'm concerned about the money that they send to the other country. And you have to demand before you sign any contract with your U.S. placement agency that you scrutinize exactly how much money goes to the other country. You need to check if that's within legal limits, first of all. But even if that is legal, you have to ask yourself if that makes sense. And then you have to ask the agency, are there programs in place to ensure that before these children were made eligible for inter-country adoption, alternatives were truly offered to the birth family? So it wasn't a matter of they lacked for $50, and so now you're spending $10,000 to adopt the child. And there aren't that many programs on really that can make that claim. There are some, if you look hard, but there aren't that many programs that can make the claim that, yes, we know when a child comes into this program that the family had the opportunity to be assisted to keep the child, and they still couldn't keep the child for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if you're willing to take special needs children, there's a lot of need. A lot of countries don't have the infrastructure for various kinds of physical and other, other problems that children have. And if you're really ready, willing, and able to take that on, there are definitely children. You have to still have to do this kind of scrutiny. But if you want a healthy young baby, you may have to deal with the fact that there just may not be very many of them.
Yeah. Well, I suppose for people who are willing to take on the challenge, and you wouldn't underestimate it, of being the parent of a child with special needs, there are American children who would be available and who would need homes if that was something that you felt that you could do.
Right. But, of course, I mean, there are people who feel particularly close to other countries. We have an NRI, non-resident Indian community here in the U.S. that is very strong, and they might find a pull back to India or something like that. But, yes, it is true that we don't have enough people to adopt foster kids here in the U.S. It's also true that that process makes a little more sense because you have the opportunity usually to foster the child first and see whether this relationship will work, and maybe have the child in the home for a year and see whether both sides are really up for this. Whereas with inter-country adoption, once the child arrives, you obviously don't want to send a child back, and so that's one of the difficulties with inter-country adoption.
Mm. Just how is it possible for people who are interested in doing inter-country adoption, and I suppose it all depends on the place and the means of the people, to actually go to the country to see the place where the child lives and to get some sense of what the situation is?
Yes. In fact, some countries require that. And in many ways, I would recommend that. The problem is that if there are language barriers, you have to find a guide who is independent of the system. Because what happens in many, many countries is that they set you up with somebody who has the monetary incentive to tell you certain things. And so the key thing when you go is, will you be able to pierce through the story that you're supposed to hear to find out what's going on underneath it? Some people who have gone over who have adopted older children have actually had the older children tell them, this isn't true, I've got a family, and so forth. But when you're adopting babies, you obviously can't count on the child themselves to know their own story. So I do recommend going over there, but part of the other thing that I would have to say is that the information is out there, but unfortunately the adoption community is sometimes hostile to it. So if you get on these internet chat groups or email groups about particular countries, sometimes they will be dominated by agencies or by people who have only adopted young children, haven't seen them grown up yet, and who just don't want to hear anything bad. And so you can't necessarily count on other people who are young parents who have adopted from that country. They may be able to tell you that this agency got me a child in a year and I was happy with the process, but that doesn't tell you whether the child was a laundered child or not.
Mm. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that for a long time for those parents who are trying to adopt children, people who live here in the United States are adopting children from outside of the country, that there were three places that the bulk of the children came from, and that was China, Guatemala, and Russia.
Right.
I think you said three quarters of the international adoptions were coming from one of those three.
Had been in prior years, from about two-thirds to three-quarters.
Yeah.
Right.
And that for a variety of reasons that they became less important, and other countries came forward to take their place.
To be more precise, they are still the top three, but their numbers are going dramatically down. And so the problem is that most other countries' numbers are just dwarfed by these three.
Uh-huh.
And other countries cycle in and out. They go up, like, say, Vietnam, Cambodia, then there's a scandal, child laundering scandal, and then they come down. But with these three countries, they look like they're going to continue to come down for very different reasons. China just doesn't seem to have as many babies, as many toddlers. They have like a 3 or 4 year waiting period right now. They just can't keep up with the demand for a variety of reasons. The flood of abandoned baby girls that they used to have just isn't there anymore. Guatemala was a corrupt system, so it's being shut down or being reworked. Russia had mostly older children in their institutions. They didn't have that many babies and toddlers anyway, but they are trying to figure out how to keep their own children because Russia has a declining birth rate and they don't have enough children left in their own society. So they're trying to go to foster care, trying to pump up domestic adoption. So each of these three countries has its own story, and really child laundering was only the key story there in Guatemala. And in China, they only got child laundering issues about the last 3 years. Before that, they had a lot of babies. They just don't have them anymore.
Well, and I think one of the things maybe I was thinking about was particularly in the Chinese case, one of the things that we have been reading just in recent years is that the Chinese government has placed growing restrictions on who may adopt. That is, on their screening of the adoptive parents has become much more stringent. And I wonder, you know, to what extent other governments are also going to be doing things like that. That is, perhaps they are going to look more carefully at the adoptive parents.
I think China's kind of special. I mean, China has reduced who can marry in terms of how much you weigh, your marital situation, how old you are, your income, but they still have a 3 or 4 year wait period of people around the world lined up to adopt. So they have way too many people who want to adopt, and they feel free to put these, you know, screenings in, because that's their idea of the best person to adopt a Chinese child. They're just reflecting Chinese values, I think. I think other countries, when they make things stricter, are mostly going to make things stricter in terms of these issues of, you know, can they trust inter-country adoption or is it too corrupt? And those corruption issues have led, really, the majority of the countries of the world, even the poor countries, are not really open for inter-country adoption. They haven't created a system for it, or they did at one point. It became too corrupt, and they realized they couldn't control it, and they just shut it down. I mean, the real tragedy here is that very, very few countries have created sustainable, non-corrupt systems. And you know, a lot of times when countries do have a spike up in the numbers, like Vietnam, Cambodia at one time, then they end up being shut down. So I don't think limitations on the kinds of people who can adopt will be the big limits, actually, outside of China.
Well, and I think one of the things that has come up in the conversation, that maybe we have this idea that there are a lot of unwanted children, or particularly unwanted healthy infants, and that that's, in fact, not really the case, but is it the case that now we have more governments that are doing what they can do to create a kind of a infrastructure within their countries and to encourage people to adopt within? That is, I'm sure that there are some children that there are children who need homes.
Yes,
and the governments
yes.
are trying to encourage their own people to adopt children in country.
Yes, that's going on in China, India, Russia. They are really trying to emphasize domestic adoption, and under international law, you're supposed to try to place a child in their own country first before turning to inter-country adoption. What has happened is that there were legal or there were cultural barriers or, you know, sometimes economic barriers in some of these countries to people doing that, but now China has changed its law, so it's easier to adopt if you're a Chinese citizen. And they're more well-off people in these countries. India has hundreds of millions of poor people, but they have hundreds of millions of middle-class people who have their own fertility problems. And, you know, healthy babies in India are being heavily adopted by people in India. And, in fact, there are wait lists if you want to adopt a child in, say, Hyderabad, India, Andhra Pradesh, India, there's a long wait list for you.
So just as a way of finishing up, I guess the question is how effective is going to be the effort, particularly the effort associated with the Hague Convention on Intercountry Adoption? How good will that be to try to deal with the problem that we've been talking about?
I think it will cut out the agencies that are the worst of the worst, the kind that don't even have a child but do an out-and-out fraud that one of the prior callers made reference to. But I really don't think it's going to be that effective to screen out child laundering. I think that the numbers are going to continue to go down simply because there aren't enough children.
Well, there we will leave it with our thanks to our guest, David Smolin. He is professor of constitutional law and also director of the Center for Biotechnology, Law, and Ethics. That's at the Cumberland School of Law at Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama. And Professor Smolin, thank you very much.
Thank you.